Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Armenians living in their indigenous lands in a region known as Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh have long experienced existential insecurity. The fighting today between Azerbaijan, which is backed by Turkey, against Armenia over who belongs in those lands is threatening to escalate into a much bigger regional war and another round of ethnic cleansing. In this hour, Doug Becker explores the causes of the conflict, the human rights implications of the aggression, and potential resolutions to the war.
I'm Doug Becker. On September 27th, 2020, fighting along the so-called line of control between Azerbaijan and the region of the Nagorno-Karabakh erupted. This area of Azerbaijan is majority Armenian and has been de facto controlled by local populations and local governance since the end of a war between the two populations in 1994. Armenians in the region, which they call Artsakh, have declared independence. Only Armenia recognizes this declaration. This new round of fighting appears to be a continuation of the conflict between this breakaway region and Azerbaijan. On today's show, we will discuss the origins of the conflict, the current outbreak, and potential pathways to peaceful settlements of the dispute, with a particular eye on issues of human rights. Our panel today is Anna Ohanian. She is the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She is the editor of Russia Abroad, Driving Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia and Beyond, and the author of Networked Regionalism as Conflict Management. Steve Swerdlow, who is the Associate Professor of Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He was Senior Central Asia Researcher at Human Rights Watch. He has co-authored reports on violations of freedom of expression and the crackdown of media freedom in Azerbaijan and has conducted human rights field research in the region. And Hurst Hannum, who is Professor of International Law Emeritus at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He is the author of Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights, and co-author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, and Practice, and also Negotiating Self-Determination. Thank you all for joining me today. Professor Ohanian, we're going to begin with you first. Could you give us a bit of an overview as to this conflict, some of the historical factors, and some of the ways in which this current conflict is similar or possibly different from the historical conflicts?
Obviously, this is a very complex conflict, as most conflicts are. What is happening right now on the ground definitely has several qualitatively new developments. The entry of Turkey, the possibility of the conflict regionalizing, becoming a proxy war. However, prior to this in general and within the scholarly community as well, this conflict was described as a post-Soviet war. The reasons for this have been several. The most recent outbreak, the conflict in its latest stage manifested in the twilight years of the Soviet years. It did start as a political contestation, the referendum that you mentioned, and I'm really covering a lot of events very quickly, but with the violence, already communal violence and clashes, there were Armenian pogroms in Baku and Sumgayit, but with the collapse of the Soviet Union, essentially Armenia and Azerbaijan found themselves as independent states, and Armenia has been supporting the Armenian community in Nagorno-Karabakh, which was legally de jure part of Azerbaijan. One thing that is critical to highlight is that the conflict emerged in the years of Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost reforms. And essentially it tested the capacity of these reforms, but also reminded the inability often of a Soviet Union as a top-down system to manage the conflict when it was still at its communal, much more manageable stages. I do want to highlight, though, and I'll conclude with this, other scholars have explained, used ethno-federalism to explain this conflict. I want to highlight that Soviet Union inherited or brought this in from the Russian Empire. There were communal clashes before Soviet Union was formed. It is also critical to highlight that that ancient hatred argument is not applied here. Armenians and Azerbaijanis are not born to hate each other. That within the Tsarist Empire, Russian Empire, and Transcaucasia, there were communal clashes, but there was also very deep, very intense interaction and cooperation between the elites. And in some respects, that connectivity within Transcaucasia as part of Russian Empire, in some respects, is way more progressive than the quality of diplomacy we see now in terms of very few contacts between Armenia and Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
You've raised some really interesting questions. We're going to explore a number of these themes in greater detail throughout the hour, including this question about sort of ancient hatreds versus this being a particularly contemporary issue. Professor Swerdlow, I know you've been in the region. Can you describe some of the causes of this conflict that you've seen and some of the concerns that you have, particularly from the perspective of human rights?
Maybe I'll try to start where Anna left off by agreeing with her that the Soviet period in particular, you know, you saw, and for really many centuries, but what I know better is the late Soviet and post-Soviet period, but there's a very long tradition of rich multicultural patchwork of deep connections and ties between Armenians and Azerbaijan. The Armenian community of Baku is one example. The Azerbaijanis that lived in Armenia shared traditions and history. Now this is happening very quickly, hour by hour, in a way that shared history, that understanding. It's been chipped away at systematically for the last three decades of this conflict, but now it's really moving quickly in a disturbingly rapid pace. And what I mean by that is we see an online vitriol, trolls on both sides, but we do see from the Azerbaijani side, which we'll get into, an authoritarian system, an authoritarian governance structure, which has really sort of taken hatred and mobilized it in this conflict. And that is one of the many tragic aspects of what we're seeing. But I think it's really important that we emphasize, I think, two things at the outset. I completely agree with Anna that this is a constructivist, this is an imagined conflict in many ways. Perceptions matter, history gets rewritten, and there are many claims on both sides. That's one thing to keep in mind, that peace is, I think, about how people envision it and you know, believing that peace is possible, and that comes from the civil societies of those societies. The other key point at the outset, I think, to make is that what we're witnessing right now is a, in terms of human rights, in my work in the region, we have a dire catastrophe of epidemic proportions. I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but we see conservative estimates today pointing to maybe 1,500 both soldiers and civilians killed so far on the Armenian and the Azerbaijani sides. We see probably among those 1,500, 70 civilians at least on both sides. But since the Azerbaijani government is not revealing information about military casualties, we have far less information about what's happening there. But just in terms of the humanitarian aspects, this is a very hot war where cluster munitions are being used, drone strikes, and we have the International Committee for the Red Cross calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities, with the primary concern at the outset of just recovering the bodies of soldiers off the battlefield. That, unfortunately, there was a ceasefire issued that was supposed to be adhered to that Russia brokered about a week ago, which was immediately not even implemented and has been disregarded. And we've seen even more fierce fighting ensuing in the past few days. And so this is an escalating conflict, and many are talking about the risk of imminent ethnic cleansing, first and foremost of the ethnic Armenian population in Nagorno-Karabakh. But this also is relevant to the 600,000 Azerbaijanis that were displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh during the conflict. So we're talking here today about memory and history. We're also talking about severe urgent human rights abuses.
Now, Professor Hanum, one of the things that complicates this conflict, at times this gets described as Armenia at war with Azerbaijan, but from a legal perspective, Nagorno-Karabakh is still a part of Azerbaijan. But there is this powerful movement for self-determination, or at least autonomy, with this Armenian community living within Azerbaijan. And of course, Professor Swerdlow just highlighted that populations had been dislocated, been moved as a result of the earlier wars that took place beginning even during the Soviet era and ending in 94. What are some of the legal challenges, some of the legal principles behind this question of this Armenian community living in Azerbaijan, wanting their independence or some degree of self-determination, yet legally being a part of Azerbaijan and a republic that's not universally, in fact, you know, barely recognized by anyone else?
Thank you very much for having me first. And you certainly raised some of the more complicating issues with respect to autonomy, self-determination, et cetera, that frankly, I don't think are going to be very important in trying to resolve the current phase of the conflict. Yes, Nagorno-Karabakh is part of Azerbaijan. I don't think that even Armenia, although I could be wrong about this, has formally recognized them as an independent state. Therefore, when we talk about self-determination, it's far too fuzzy a word. And what we're really talking about is independence. And if they want to, eventual unification with Armenia. The problem is that international law as it is, and I'm not saying that this is good, but I am confident in telling you what it is, doesn't recognize any right to independence from any group just because it wants it, or even because it suffered fairly serious human rights violations. Many people think there should be a kind of humanitarian exception for secession, so that if you really have suffered, perhaps the best example of this would be Kosovo in the former Yugoslav Republic. But that remains an exception. And even Kosovo, in its declaration of independence, was very careful to avoid the word self-determination, to avoid the word secession. And it was just a unique situation. Well, there are no unique situations. And at the same time, they're all unique. So looking to law, I think, isn't going to help us very much. If peace is possible, as Steve said, and I hope very much that he's right, it will only come if we recognize what has already been mentioned, and that is the people who've been killed already, both military and civilian. I don't even think, frankly, that the memory of how wonderful things were under the Soviet Union until the early 1990s is going to help us very much either. There's hardly a country in the world where some ethnic group wouldn't like to govern itself, whatever that means. That's no guarantee that that government is going to be democratic. That's no guarantee that it's going to be honest. But I think law, at least, has come for a change to the right decision by saying, essentially, go ahead and try. There's no law against secession. But what you have to do is either, if you're in the 19th century, gain the support of the great powers, or in the 20th century, I suppose, 21st century now, gain the support of some people who will give you lots of weapons. All of this, it seems to me, and I'm not an expert in the region, comes back to Russia. And since it seems to have been providing weapons to just about everyone who wants them, I hope that we'll get a chance to even mention whether or not any resolution is possible without the agreement of Russia, not just its help, its agreement.
Yes, Steve, you had a response to that.
Well, not so much a response, but just as we're getting started, I have to say it's a huge honor to be on a panel with Hurst, someone whose text on international human rights really formed me as a student and hopefully as a practitioner. But I actually wanted to just, if we could, I know this is scholar's circle, so in very few panels would I be able to ask a question of the expert. But I am curious about, because, you know, in truth, I completely agree with Hurst that the legal analysis of whether or not self-determination and the the criteria of actual independence are met here. While that may not be directly relevant to ending the hostilities today, it is a question that both Azerbaijanis and Armenians are asking every day, every hour online. And I keep seeing that question being brought out. So I wanted to actually ask Hurst, you know, in the application of the Montevideo convention or principles, I'm curious at how he analyzes this fact pattern, which is, as we see, it's getting discussed now, even though it's somewhat of secondary importance, that Nagorno-Karabakh, the local assembly, the local parliamentary structure in the late Soviet period before the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1988, declared its own independence, I believe, and Anna will correct me, before Azerbaijan declared its independence from the Soviet Union. There's a big dispute about the legitimacy of that declaration of independence, the relevance it has. And then there's, of course, the more important central facts that apply to the self-determination question, which is that the overwhelming majority of that territory was ethnic Armenian. And then there's the question of control. And again, Hurst is the expert, so he can jump in with the criteria. But I think that it's important because, again, and it's interesting, it's astounding to me, but that self-determination question and whether the criteria are met is being discussed as we're also trying to follow the urgent humanitarian catastrophe.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to have Hurst respond, then I'm going to have Anna respond as well.
I simply wanted to add questions to Steve's.
Absolutely. Anna, please.
My two questions are, another argument that I have seen being debated and discussed is that essentially Nagorno-Karabakh was given to Azerbaijan by Stalin. So essentially Nagorno-Karabakh has never been part of independent Azerbaijan. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the Utai Prosodatis argument was applied, meaning that 15 republics were recognized, but on the condition that they would protect the minorities within their states, but that condition was not really reinforced. So the first question that I wanted to add, what Professor Hanım thinks about that argument that Nagorno-Karabakh has not been part of Azerbaijan. And the second one that, again, is back, sort of emerged is in the public space, is the remedial sovereignty. I think Professor mentioned Kosovo, and the fact that now President Aliyev rejected Russian peacekeepers, saying that this is in my territory and I don't need peacekeepers, which is his right to do. But at the same time, he clearly reserves the right to bomb Stepanakert, the civilians, which are legally part of his state, which essentially raises this difficult question, what does sovereignty mean? And then the whole conversation of popular sovereignty, etc.
I'll actually add two quick things to what Anna seems to be indicating. Certainly could play a norm of the responsibility to protect, certainly could play a role. But I can't help but point out that the same argument about territory being given by Soviet leaders was always cited by the Russians in their annexation of Crimea. That was land that was given to Ukraine by Khrushchev. So certainly not unique. In any case, Professor Hanım, you have a number of questions you've been asked. I'm going to give you plenty of opportunity to respond.
Well, maybe we can begin by saying that foolish consistency with respect to self-determination is the hobgoblin of little minds. Nagorno-Karabakh certainly meets the criteria for statehood. So does California. So does Chechnya. So does almost any territory in the world that has a government. And that, by the way, has nothing to do with ethnicity. It's simply a functioning government. There are a number of states that don't meet the criteria for statehood, but they are states because they used to be colonies. I mean, my view of what self-determination is and what secession is and whether or not there's a right to it comes out of basically looking at international law since the United Nations. The United Nations changed many things. One of the things that it changed was that it shifted this whole notion of self-determination from a principle in the 19th century that was generally won or lost by the use of force, to a norm of international law. But that norm was incredibly narrow. And it's truly unfortunate that the UN used that broad word of self-determination, because who can be against that? What self-determination still means today, in my view at least, is the right of former colonies of European powers to be independent. That's all. And if you look at the history of the way the UN and the world has dealt with all of the ethnic groups who wanted secession from Sudan, from Nigeria, from India, from any place else you want, What comes along with self-determination is territorial integrity. And not surprisingly, every state that's recognized as one would prefer to have its territorial integrity respected. You have only to look at Yugoslavia, which is a wonderful example of all of these things and how there are very few good lawyers and not very many good politicians around either. I think it's also important not to confuse the problem, which in this case is not ethnic hatreds. I agree with certainly maybe some disagreements over fundamental issues and even human rights violations and identifying those and trying to stop those, with the second part, which is what is the remedy for these violations? In no case, and again, even with Kosovo, I think it's quasi-independent now, recognized by over 100 states, more because the world decided that Serbs were bad guys, rather than because it had any right to independence because it was repressed by Serbia. But I think that what's important to remember is that, and if this is what we're seeing on blogs and on in chat rooms, then tell people to forget about it because it's not going to help. The self-determination or the, whether it was in part of Russia or Azerbaijan in what, the 1917, the 1920s, the 1930s is absolutely irrelevant to anything that's going on there now. And I wish this weren't the case. I wish there were more respect for international law in many cases. But as I started off saying, I think that we're stuck. You don't have to be independent. And I'm glad someone raised the issue of autonomy. The trouble is that nobody wants autonomy. That's second place. You can be perfectly happy as an autonomous region. Scotland, Catalonia. I think most places where human rights are respected, most countries, still have elements of that country that want to be independent. It's not because they're repressed, it's because of money and greed and wanting a seat at the UN. That's an unfair characterization of the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh, but only partly so. And so I think what's more important is to try to identify if there is a solution, but a solution to what problem? If the problem is that Azerbaijan wants to be a state that keeps all its territory, and there's not a state in the entire world that doesn't believe that it has that right, versus the right of a part of its state to be independent, then there is no solution. So let's look at what's behind the issue and look at, as Anna suggested, some of the history and some of the meddling from neighbors. If I was in between Russia, Turkey, and Iran, I wouldn't be very happy either. And so maybe what we need to do is try to figure out a way to make the Caucasus into something that we had in the 19th century. Buffer states, protected states, I mean, who knows what. But today, and Anna's right, that sovereignty would be wonderful to explain, but it kind of means whatever anybody else recognizes you to be. There's not a very good test, as I said. Nagorno-Karabakh certainly could be sovereign, but a lot has to happen, and the most important thing that has to happen is the rest of the world has to recognize it, not just that Nagorno-Karabakh wants it.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We've been discussing the origins and the human rights implications of the conflict in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Upcoming, we will discuss potential options for conflict resolution, including the emphasis on a human rights or protectionist model. Now, Anna, one thing that certainly I want to kind of return back to is these issues have been simmering in the region for quite some time. But why 2020? What's going on now that caused this, what I think most of us would have described as a frozen conflict since 1994, though there's certainly been periods of incursion and violence and aggression from the different periods, but this is an escalation that we really haven't seen, I think it's fair to say, since 94. What's behind this specific outbreak?
So most of the narrative on this conflict remains focused on geopolitics. Bigger powers, major powers, which is definitely These are very important factors. Obviously, Turkey is basically a conflict party, and I'll talk about Turkey in a minute. But what I do think is overlooked, and perhaps it's harder to explain in the media, is the domestic drivers of foreign policies, both of Armenia and Azerbaijan, more so for Azerbaijan and Turkey in this case. I have argued in my work, and I should mention, I just had an edited volume on Armenia's Velvet Revolution with Lawrence Browers, where I, in both chapters, I've looked exactly at this question. Essentially, after the Velvet Revolution in Armenia, which was not a color revolution, it was bottom up, driven by the masses, driven by broader civil society. The Velvet Revolution in South Caucasus created a democratic dyad, which I think it changed the structure of the political fabric in the region. Numerous studies focused on the regional dimension of politics, quantitative studies, have demonstrated that in a region, when the democratic pole becomes stronger, that creates pressure on the remaining authoritarian regime to defend its system. And in addition, it also creates pressure on militarized approaches to unresolved conflict. So when the Velvet Revolution broke out, I was excited in terms of new options and possibilities that this could open up in building, revitalizing peace systems and addressing the very dangerous security dilemmas in which people have found themselves. So this democratic dyad between Georgia and Armenia created pressure on Aliyev. And this summer, Belarus, there were protests happening in Belarus. Most of the analysts were referring to Lukashenko as the last dictator of Europe. And guess what? He's not the last dictator of Europe, if we consider South Caucasus in Europe. Belarus and Armenia are significant as democratic breakthroughs, depending what happens in Belarus, because they're happening in Russia's authoritarian orbit. So Aliyev had one choice: to reform the country, and the Azerbaijani economy is overdue for this. It's a petrostate without representative institutions, and the pressure on petrostates is only going to increase because global capital markets are shifting towards green energy systems. Such instabilities are going to increase in petrostates. So Aliyev, essentially using a push factor, pulled in Erdogan. Not that Erdogan was hesitant to go in. Erdogan has been eyeing this region for a while, but there was a push and pull factor. So it was easier for Aliyev to pull in Erdogan to support its regime through this war. And I do look at this specific instance as a diversionary war. That definitely huge factor. Also critical, I do want to highlight as to how the inclusion of Turkey, entry of Turkey as a conflict party changed the structure. Turkey is already involved in Syria, is already involved in Libya, the Mediterranean. But what Turkey has been using in its foreign policy, number one, Erdogan has Islamized Turkish foreign policy, but also has been regularly using Islamic fundamentalists and mercenaries. And this is already, I'm not going to debate whether this is the case, this is broadly established. So mercenaries were brought in from Syria and dropped on Azeri side. And essentially this has negative implications for the region as a whole, because studies show that the inclusion of mercenaries, the proxy wars, the inclusion of this privatization of violence extends the duration of a conflict, an unfortunate, already a protracted conflict that already is much longer. State formations, civil wars, which Nagorno-Karabakh is the kind, internationalized civil war over territory. The average lifespan of these conflicts is around 30 years compared to 8 years for typical civil wars, which are not over secession, state formation, and territory. So you drop in privatized mercenaries, privatization of violence that already has been on an increase worldwide from 5% at the beginning in early 2000s, and the increase is by 40%. That's the trend that we see happening. This is going to increase the duration of this conflict, which is already difficult to win militarily as a state formation conflict, and it already also difficult to negotiate through a peace agreement.
Yes, it's always so tricky in the negotiations. The more actors certainly within and the more resources can always complicate the negotiations. Mm-hmm. You're painting a picture that one of the problems that's transformed this conflict is what was largely an internal or this very tightly regional conflict has become more internationalized. Steve, on that question, is that really sort of one of the keys here, the fact that it's becoming more internationalized, Turkey's interests, certainly Russia would noticeably have interests, and if that's the case, what's sort of the some cursory ways to perhaps de-escalate by returning to more of a local issue as opposed to this internationalization?
I agree with Anna that we have to keep our eyes trained on the domestic drivers first and foremost, because obviously they are much more invested and much more the determinants of how this conflict will be resolved. And I'll get to the international aspects. I think obviously Turkey's concurrent or coincident with Azerbaijan's crackdown on human rights over the past decade, we've also seen a severe crackdown on democratic movements and dissidents, so-called Gulenists and others all across Turkey's civil society for the past for many years now, which has obviously amped up militarism, military adventurism, and really makes it very difficult to deal with Turkey and leverage, you know, the ability to stop its involvement in this. But I wanted to say that I think two things that are really important inside Azerbaijan, to just begin with that and then move outward, is the systematic destruction of civil society. It really, as Anna said, Azerbaijan has transformed into a very hardcore authoritarian state more and more over the past two decades under Ilham Aliyev, obviously dynastic succession taking over from his father, Gaidar Aliyev. He has really picked off all of the activists that were talking about peace, that were engaged in peace building or any even flirting with ideas of peace, that were human rights activists, journalists, and he's really eliminated all of the opposition parties, censored the internet, imposed travel bans, or in other cases, forced other courageous activists into exile. And that's been very difficult. It's very difficult to engage with the civil society when that civil society is not free. At the same time as the crackdown on human rights, I'd say in my visits to Azerbaijan, I've been, in my fieldwork, I've been also struck by, and this was more anecdotal and not something I conducted systematic research on, like the human rights crackdown, but the production of Armenophobia, the sort of the obsession with creating an enemy, othering Armenians, erasing the legacy of Armenians in Baku and other parts of the country, their cultural production, their you know the shared history as we were discussing in the beginning. And that's been a scary phenomenon to witness because it's been very much mobilized in educational textbooks, in schools, you know, and as we said, we're talking again about the beginning about ancient hatreds, constructing a vision of Armenians as fascists, aggressors, terrorists, really putting these really harmful narratives out there in the public in a wide way. And that's not to say that that doesn't happen also on the other side. It does. There's been a demonization of Azerbaijanis and Turks in Armenia in a way that's not helpful. But I don't think they compare because of the mechanism of the state that's used in Azerbaijan is much different, much more streamlined, and it's very scary at this moment online. So I wanted to mention that. Also, this in terms of the actual victims of the conflict, the 600,000 displaced persons from Azerbaijan that had to leave their homes at the end of the war as it concluded in 1994, for many years were prevented from being moved into sustainable housing in other parts of the country and kept in specific areas closer to the conflict zone as a way of, in a way, showcasing and highlighting the victims of the conflict as a way of focusing attention on what some have called the lachrymose theory of history or this victimization complex, which made it all the harder to resume any dialogue. So I think those have been really destructive forces. In terms of internationally, yes, Turkey, again, it's a human rights crisis that's run away. Also Russia, politics have become cynical and we've lost that sense. Public opinion in Russia and how it looks at this is ignored by the Kremlin. Putin, I think, increasingly doesn't really care what Armenians and Azerbaijanis in Russia have to say about this. And finally, we can get more into this, but obviously the absence of the U.S. at this moment is allowing this to spiral out of control. We've seen a recent tweet from Secretary Pompeo that was laughable in its indifference to what's happened. I think the tweet about 2 days ago was essentially, we hope the Armenians will survive this, but we're not going to do anything about it. And I think it's just absolutely destructive, completely irresponsible to have the U.S. abdicate its authority. We know why that's happening. There's a lot of other things on the horizon, but we need to see U.S. and EU engagement immediately in order to forestall further ethnic cleansing.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we have been discussing the human rights and international legal obligations of Azerbaijan in its war against Nagorno-Karabakh, also known as Artsakh. Up next, we explore potential resolutions to the conflict, including the importance of advancing democracy in the region.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Hurst Hannum, I would love to get your thoughts on the broad rights-based approach, this concept of the responsibility to protect and the role that might play as a form of resolution, either supporting some notion of self-determination on the part of the Armenians, or at least calling Azerbaijan to task to protect the rights of this minority within the region. There's been a number of references to responsibility to protect since this conflict has broken out. Is that a fruitful way to view a potential conflict resolution mechanism?
In a word, no. The only people who talk about the responsibility to protect are academics and a center in New York and the Canadian government, I think. It's never been accepted by the UN. Most of the third world is against it. And most people who talk about it are the ones who are going to be doing the intervening, not those who are going to be intervened against. I have no objection to the concept in principle, but I think a bit like self-determination is not a very good place to start, because it means using force to stop terrible things, genocide, crimes against humanity, et cetera, et cetera. That's okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's nothing that's going to get support if one is looking for a peaceful resolution of the conflict. I did want to follow up a bit on this question of internationalization, because I think it's important to be careful what you wish for. Nagorno-Karabakh has been internationalized since, 1994, 1995? We have the wonderful OSCE that's been taking care of it. The Azeris, displaced and now and forgotten by their co-ethnicists and religious, remind me a lot of the Palestinians. I'd say that's been internationalized pretty well too, hasn't it? Does that work better? Kosovo became independent because of NATO's bombs, not because NATO or the EU or the US were very good at diplomacy. And frankly, while we can't get rid of Russia, Turkey, and let's leave Iran out of it, Russia and Turkey are enough. While we can't get rid of them, the thing I think to me that seems most important is to come back to this notion of what's going on domestically is really almost the only thing that counts. And if there's any willingness, if there's any positive aspect to peace that can be sold to both, well, to three parties, and let's remember there are three. There are the Azeris, there are the Armenians, and then there are the people of Artsakh. And they don't always agree with all of their Armenian brothers and sisters. Because if something can develop from inside, and it's going to be difficult in Azerbaijan, obviously, but even if it's at the top levels, then I think the goal should be to un-internationalize the conflict and to leave up the people who, in some sense, started it, who started it again in 2020, and who are going to have to finish it, not to look out for the white knight of the UN or the OSCE or anyone else to come and save them. And I hate to keep talking about what shouldn't be done, but it's my turn to pose a question, and that is exactly the one you posed just a few minutes ago, is not even so much how might we get to a solution, but what would my two colleagues on the panel see, who know much more about the situation than I do, as one or two feasible ultimate solutions. Okay? One problem with conflict resolution is it pretends that everything's on the table, and it's not, of course. And it pretends that people will come to the table not knowing what's going to come out the other end. And I think it's often useful, whether it's in Northern Ireland or Aceh or Nagorno-Karabakh, to know what isn't and is on the table. So does it have to be independence? Does it have to be unification? Can we just look at a map and put a little corridor connecting the part of Azeri that's surrounded by Armenia and put in a little corridor so that Nagorno-Karabakh can be a part of Armenia? That's far too simple. Might actually work, but it's far too simple and it wouldn't be any fun. So what would the two of you see as, even if it's not very feasible, as a desirable outcome, apart from everybody just getting together and hugging one another? Although that wouldn't be a bad idea either.
Wonderful question. Let's turn to Anna first. I know that you've written about this issue of democratization and the way that democratization and regional democratization could have impacts on conflict resolution. And you've emphasized the democratization in the South Caucasus. In what ways does this democratization complicate the conflict, and does it provide a pathway out of the conflict?
That's a great way of putting it. Just to clarify, Professor Hanum, when I do talk about internationalization of the conflict, I primarily talk about the conflict manifestations, the drives, the possibility of a spillover, it becoming a proxy war. But I fully agree with you. And in my work, I have always emphasized this, and there's so much data that supports this as well. The need of local solutions. So even, you know, I'm sure you know the work of Jean-Paul Lederach, right? The importance of grassroots, which I don't think we're there in this point. Looking at, in terms of ways out and the role of democracy, the way democratization helps with peace building is that, as Steve already mentioned, it reinforces the nonviolence as a factor. It creates new stakeholders. It activates new voices. And most importantly, decentralizes power. Militarization and authoritarianism are mutually reinforcing, and they are both driven by centralization of power. Decentralization is essential for peace agreements to form, for peace agreements to be implemented and to last. Majority, I'm forgetting, I cannot cite specific data, but majority of peace agreements collapse within less than 3 years. And there's a lot of lessons learned that having civil society at the table, having all parties at the table, having women at the table, all of these are factors, are markers of strong peace agreements and effective peace processes. We don't see any of that in this conflict. The OSCE process, and I've been writing about this and being hammered by all sides, the OSCE peace process is top heavy. I can name the people who have been involved as the political elite on both of my hands, right? Previously, before these developments, I've advocated for investing time in institutions first, democratization first, hoping, especially after Armenia's Velvet, that was the best structural condition for Azerbaijan to democratize. But in this current condition, I've always was skeptical that this search for this elusive big bang deal that will be developed and will trickle down, I've never believed in that. It's a package or step by step. Preparing people for peace, there's just not enough contacts, not enough institutional infrastructure, not enough connectivity to sustain that. However, looking after these developments, this massive militarization driven by authoritarianism, essentially the primary challenge is to carve out a political space to arrive at something. Ending the war and ending the violence, the ceasefire, is critical. I do not know what the optimal solution is, and I should know it. I do not live in the region. That's a decision that rests with the people. But I'm primarily very much concerned for processes. I'm an institutionalist at heart. I should also note that the international world order tends to shape both conflict dynamics, but also what's possible at the negotiation table. These types of conflicts that are protracted state formation, studies show that these types of conflicts have been tended to be ended or mediated by either negotiation by conflict parties, as Professor Hanum effectively pointed out. The second most frequently used option is mediation. And that also good news is that after World War II, the number of possibility of mediators has increased. The optimal solution is to have an international organization with a mediation or negotiation with the support of international organizations. But the fact that ceasefire is critical, militarization has not been taken off the table. Violence remains legitimate in the region. And I was hopeful, and I was going actually to do research on this summer, that post-Velvet, the Pashinyan government could be really on the offensive in pushing the value of nonviolence in the region. He has made remarks. He talked about the importance of the needs for Azerbaijan, but I did not see aggressive diplomacy, and that could be explained by the fact that this was a democratic breakthrough in an authoritarian orbit. So his language was even constrained. So that's a speculation. Let me conclude answering your question in terms of the liberal peace building. This has been very kind of rights-based, focused on market, and openness and trade and human rights and democracy. Obviously, I'm citing the work of Roland Paris and others, but this model has been criticized for not paying too much attention to the institutions. So now the discourse is on bringing the state back in. What we see right now, I think this model remains superior in terms of it is human rights based, it is not coercive, militarized, coercive approaches, victory consolidation, those are all have declining utility. Liberal peace building rests on participatory mechanisms and strengthening of institutions. I just finished a book manuscript that is under review, so it's not reviewed yet. I probably should not be citing that research, but I do want to share that I think we, especially in this world, especially after post-Cold War period, we have been associating democracy with the West, the color revolutions, the Western democracy promotion projects, getting this post-Soviet societies to unlearn some of the bad habits that they have been learning, and I'm guilty of that. But doing this deep historical dive, what stares at me looking at this imperial peripheries is that actually these minority communities in large empires, they did know a thing or two about self-governance in largely coercive authoritarian systems, that it is about self-governance. It is about connectivity. It is about certain kind of connectivity. And I do think that moving forward, we have to figure out how to build, rewire these connections for people to have voices. Unless these systems become democratic, I don't see a way out. President Aliyev has captured the peace processes when he came to power, much different than his father, I have to say. Any talk of civil society, any talk of Azerbaijani people, Armenian people together that Pashinyan has been saying, that's a code word. He reads it as civil society empowerment. And Steve already spoke about this. Very often, whenever Aliyev wanted to go after civil society groups or activists, he would just slap them with, oh, they have been working with Armenians. And then he turns around and says, yes, we want to give autonomy to Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. So I think to me, it is about connectivity, it is about self-governance, it is about representative institutions, whether we're going to call it democracy or not, whether we're going to call it national self-determination or not, does not concern me as much. I'm much more hopeful and eager to see processes being built in, institutions to be created as a way to move out.
Anna's focused quite a bit on processes, on the institutions, and then the expectation then, I suppose, would be whatever the outcome would be would come out of those institutions. Professor Hanum, though, does, you know, raise an interesting question. So I'll ask it of you, Steve. What would a resolution look like? And specifically, I'll ask you, is there a resolution possible that would include Nagorno-Karabakh remaining in Azerbaijan, or if this region remains within Azerbaijan, are conflicts just going to be endemic?
Let me see how I can duck this one, because this is impossible to answer as Anna said, you know, not being a member of either community, it's incredibly presumptuous, you know, to take a position. But in a human rights respecting Azerbaijan, this would be a different conversation about autonomy. And I agree very much with Anna that by really interrogating closely what's happened in Azerbaijan and to the Azerbaijani people, that largely explains why the option of autonomy or of remaining within Azerbaijan is completely off the table for the other side. And so I think that's why we're focusing so much on that. Of course, it's not the position of the human rights community to pass final judgment on what the ideal political arrangement is. It's a decision that has to be determined by both sides. I want to push back a bit on what Hurst was saying about, you know, will further engagement or let's say involvement from the UN, from the OSCE or other international actors, will that create a further quagmire? And should we be skeptical, you know, of, you know, looking at Israel-Palestine and what comes of that, looking at much of what's happened in the Balkans, should we be very skeptical about calling for those things? And of course, he's right to be very cautious. And, you know, I guess you could say that I'm coming from the camp of human rights activists that, you know, in many cases, we do call for humanitarian intervention in the face of egregious, ongoing human rights abuses. And there's many reasons to be cautious about that. But I want to gently push back or maybe explain why I think that we want principled engagement by these actors to get to a solution, or we need this now. And so I do have a wish list, even though I ducked the initial question. So my wish list starts thus. International humanitarian law has to be immediately respected. So we want an immediate cessation. As I mentioned in the beginning, we need to see the ICRC operating. We need to see the Geneva Conventions on both sides respected. We have seen a targeting of civilian infrastructure and of civilians on both sides. We see it in Ganja on the Azerbaijani side, second largest city in Azerbaijan. We see it in Stepanakert and other places. It's scary. It needs to stop now. So the international humanitarian law concerns, they have to be raised by somebody. They have to be raised by Washington, by Brussels, by the UN in New York, by the Security Council, by the OSCE. And on human rights, it's a much longer wish list for what we want to see in Azerbaijan. But let me make the argument that were we to see, and Anna laid out that Azerbaijan and Armenia are in Europe, were we to see that the European Court of Human Rights, that its judgments were actually implemented by Azerbaijan, that they were relevant, that they were used, then you would see a more rights-respecting Azerbaijan. You might see an autonomy. You might see a solution in which Armenians in Azerbaijan had their rights respected. You don't. But what I think we need to push as hard as we can to have more Euro-Atlantic integration of Azerbaijan into, it's already a member of the Council of Europe, but it's not upholding the judgments. It's not upholding the human rights obligations that it must. So that's important. On the OSCE, I'm also skeptical. Anna's right, it's top heavy. There's a lot of problems with it. But guess what? I think that the presence of an OSCE peacekeeping force in the Donbas region has done a lot of good. That has helped in terms of, you know, East Ukraine, Russia and Ukraine at war. At least we have something. We have something standing in the way between, you know, militants on both sides. That's important. And I think that, you know, we've already seen the OSCE call for the Moscow mechanism to be used in this conflict. So we've already seen a call for there to be investigations of the human rights abuses that are being committed, or the humanitarian law violations, the war crimes. That should happen. We need investigation. I forgot to mention the beginning of my list. Of course, I'm come from the NGO community. We need to see access for journalists and NGOs on the Azerbaijani side. I'm seeing a lot of journalists reporting from Karabakh. I'm not hearing of correspondents really or amnesty researchers on the Azerbaijani side. Were we to get more access, get more clarity and transparency, we'd learn a lot more. We'd be able to make recommendations. So that's a lot of things. But what I'm really calling for, I do think we need robust, principled engagement by the OSCE, which unfortunately is not in any position to do so, given its lack of senior leadership at this time for several months now.
I'm going to give Hearst Hanum the last word, since you'd asked the question and gotten the responses from your colleagues. How much are they instilling confidence in you that whether it's a democratization approach that Anna had suggested and the engagement of civil society and certainly some engagement of international actors, legal actors, peacekeeping actors coming from Steve, how much confidence does that instill in you that there's a peaceful resolution to this conflict?
Well, instilling confidence is difficult about almost anything these days. But I do think that there's a possibility of a peaceful resolution. And I would agree with everything that that Stephen and Anna said. I mean, of course, international humanitarian law has to be respected. That won't stop the war, though. It'll just stop civilians from being targeted. Democracy would be great. Spain is a democracy. Well, there wasn't a war between Spain and Catalonia, but democracy is not enough. I am in favor of outsiders getting engaged, but it has to be a very thoughtful engagement. We can protect human rights and not give a damn about what the borders are in the Caucasus. And human rights people should remember that. And grand diplomats and statesmen perhaps do care about the borders and what's a state and what isn't. But independence is no guarantee of human rights. Steve, with all your work with Human Rights Watch, you're the first one to know that. So I would say that I remain hopeful. I think that anyone who is engaged in human rights has to be cynical, but you also have to be optimistic. And I think we all remain that way. And I do agree that our concerns, whether the four of us or your listeners, needs to be with trying to do something in the short run to stop the violence insofar as we can. But there does have to be more thinking than has been done in the last 30 years about what comes next. And whether it's with democracy or not, that shouldn't matter that much. Human rights, that does matter more.
Thank you very much. Our guests today have been Anna Ohanian. She is the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She's the editor of Russia Abroad, Driving Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia and Beyond, and the author of Networked Regionalism as Conflict Management. Steve Swerdlow is the Associate Professor of Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He was the Senior Central Asia Researcher at Human Rights Watch and has co-authored a report on violations of freedom of expression and the crackdown on media freedoms in Azerbaijan, as well as having conducted field research in the region. And Hearst Hanum, who is Professor of International Law Emeritus from Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, he is the author of Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights, and co-author of Negotiating Self-Determination. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for your excellent hosting.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hearst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.